Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information available at chevron.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. urscorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Just ahead, Steve Jobs, a quintessential California kid, how he rejected conformity in building Apple, and a day in the life of a California parole agent, how they keep track of ex-felons, many of them without jobs or a stable place to live, to try and make sure they stay out of trouble.
I feel like I'm chasing ghosts because I'm just basically going from one hotel to the other or one street corner to the other or a homeless shelter looking for him.
Plus, a man who's running the California coast to honor his mother who's battling Parkinson's disease.
I'm sure my mom would probably appreciate a letter and a hug more than, you know, me putting myself at risk out on a dangerous and remote trail. But this is what she's getting. She's getting a big I love you over 60 days.
It's the California Report. Well, you might have to go back as far as Walt Disney to find one person so identified with the success of a California company as Steve Jobs and Apple. His resignation this week as CEO for health reasons leaves people wondering about the future of a company that changed so much, from how we buy and listen to music to the way we keep in touch with our friends and families. Earlier this week, we went to San Francisco's South Park, where lots of high-tech workers nearby spend their lunch hours, to ask folks about Steve Jobs.
John Malatesta, and I'm retired. I was a computer programmer. You know, I've always been kind of a PC guy, but, you know, I have an iPad and an iPhone, and, you know, and I really appreciate them. And, you know, I'm glad that he was there and did that.
Jim Hopp, and I work here at Lookout Mobile. You know, I was sad to hear that his medical issues were going to mean that he couldn't be the CEO anymore, because he's been an icon in the industry. He's done a lot of innovative things, surely through force of will. I have to admit, back in the, you know, mid-90s, I was thinking, you need to just go to commodity hardware, you need to license it to other people, you're just going to be dead if all you do is, it's our hardware, and it's our platform, and it's totally closed. And he proved that if you build a, you know, something that everybody has to have, that they will buy it from a single company and pay more than they would pay if they went elsewhere, because it's worth it.
Brianna Schweitzer. I work in advertising. Well, I love Apple products, and I've always worked on Apples at home. So, and I work on Apples exclusively for work for many, many years. I don't know what the loss of him to the company will be, and hopefully Apple will keep being cool.
Kyle Stoneman. I'm the user experience designer for Change.org. I think he is probably the greatest business story ever told. He was absolutely ruthlessly committed to design in a way that most business people are not. He drives people to do great things and was able to motivate people to basically innovate and innovate and out-innovate, you know, the company out of bankruptcy and redefine what a computer is in this current decade. It's amazing.
A few of the thoughts from people we talked to at lunchtime this week in San Francisco's South Park neighborhood about the genius, the influence of Steve Jobs and Apple. Laura Seidel, digital culture correspondent for NPR, is here with us now. And Laura, what we heard that one gentleman referring to Steve Jobs innovating his way out of near bankruptcy, what was it about him that enabled him to take a company on the brink of failure to become one of the most valuable companies in the world?
One of the things that's most interesting about Steve Jobs is his gut, his ability to see what consumers would want before they even knew what they wanted. So if you go back very, very early in his career, when he went to the Xerox Research Lab, where they actually invented the first mouse and the first graphical user interface, he saw it. And the minute he saw it, he thought, that is it. And he then went and recreated these things in a way that made consumers love them. He's had this ability with so many products.
he had sort of an uncanny intuition almost, and a self.
Well, has. Let's remember, he is still with us.
Exactly, he does, and he is here and probably going to have an influence for some time to come. But he gave a commencement speech at Stanford in 2005, which a lot of people talked about. And in it, he talks about dropping out of college. He went to Reed College up in Oregon. And when he dropped out, he took a calligraphy class. Let's hear him talk about that, and then we'll come back.
It was beautiful, historical, artistically subtle in a way that science can't capture. And I found it fascinating. None of this had even a hope of any practical application in my life. But 10 years later, when we were designing the first Macintosh computer, it all came back to me. And we designed it all into the Mac. It was the first computer with beautiful typography. If I had never dropped in on that single course in college, the Mac would have never had multiple typefaces or proportionally spaced fonts. And since Windows just copied the Mac, it's likely that no personal computer would have them.
Poking a little bit of fun there at his longtime rival. And Laura Seidel, like Microsoft and Bill Gates, Steve Jobs has been inseparable from Apple for so many years. He's the voice, he's the face of the company. And looking ahead to the fall, we've got a new iPhone coming out. What's that rollout going to be like?
There's a good chance that Steve Jobs will not be there to unveil it. And, you know, the thing about Apple products, they are indeed great, but I'm sure that Steve Jobs' charisma has been part of making them so popular.
It's created almost a cult.
Yes. And, you know, having seen him, I don't know, countless times now give these presentations, I actually have walked out and I always say to my editor, okay, you need to help me get out of the field of distortion that I'm in, because he is such a good salesman. And the people who are coming in, Tim Cook now as CEO, and there are others that are part of this handpicked team, Scott Forstall, Phil Schiller, none of them have that kind of charisma. I mean, listen, when you hear him talk, he just has a way of speaking that just draws you in. So very hard shoes to fill.
Well, let me ask you a question about that, because he is a California boy, Steve Jobs. If, just say, he had been on the East Coast, let's say he had gone to MIT or something and stayed around back there, do you think, just speculate a little bit, you know, could what he did have happened back there?
You know, I think that's a good question, and it's one I think about. I think he is really a product of Northern California. I mean, he was born and raised here. He grew up, you know, in the 60s and 70s, which were wild times here. So, you know, he did things like he traveled to India. He did all those kind of hippie things. And I think that really has something to do with the fact that he is kind of an iconoclast. He doesn't mind questioning authority. And in many ways, I think that is a kind of Northern California thing. Back east, where I am from, I think people are much more hierarchical, much more interested in what school you went to.
A lot more conformity.
A lot more conformity. And, you know, that is not Steve Jobs. And I think it has enabled him in many ways to be the success that he has been.
Tim Cook has been the acting CEO of Apple for some time. He'll be now taking over from Steve Jobs. What do we know about him? Where did he come from? And, you know, what did Steve Jobs, why did Steve Jobs pick him?
Well, he has been at Apple for over a decade. And this isn't the first time that he will be in the role of CEO. He's been acting CEO several times now, as Steve Jobs has taken medical leave. In 2009, he was there for two quarters. The company did wonderfully. Tim Cook has basically been a logistics guy. He's been the guy who has set up Apple's supply chain. He's done an incredibly good job at it. He doesn't have the kind of charisma that Steve Jobs has, but people say he really is very detail-oriented, like his boss. He certainly is a guy who has shown and proved that he can run Apple.
Laura Seidel, she's digital culture correspondent for NPR. Thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
At any given time, more than 100,000 parolees walk the streets of California. When they leave prison, most are assigned to a parole agent, a state officer who keeps track of what they're up to and tries to keep them from committing new crimes. Earlier this month, as part of an ongoing look at how California's parole system is changing, I spent a couple days with one of the people on the front lines.
My name is Martin Figueroa. I'm a parole agent with the state of California, and we're in San Francisco, and we're going to start doing some home visits.
Martin Figueroa is wearing blue jeans, a plaid shirt, white sneakers, and a black zip-up hoodie. It helps him blend in, he says. But underneath his jacket, handcuffs, pepper spray, and, just in case, a 9mm Smith & Wesson pistol with extra bullets. If there's one sound that exemplifies Agent Figueroa's job, it's this. We're standing outside one of San Francisco's most notorious public housing projects. At 8 in the morning, it's eerily quiet. He's looking for one of his parolees, Ricky Foster. It's the third time Figueroa has tried to contact him in 4 or 5 days. No one answers the door, and Figueroa turns to leave when a young man opens an upstairs window and pops his head out.
How you doing? Hey, what? Yeah, I'm his parole officer. How you doing?
We had a family reunion.
The parolee's brother explains why Foster isn't there.
And then I was trying to give him that note about calling you, so...
But Figueroa is losing patience.
Well, he should be back today.
Okay, tell him
he needs
to be at the office tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
He needs to come see me tomorrow.
All right.
Okay? Can you do that?
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Lando.
All right.
Have a good day.
Figueroa jots down the details of this brief exchange on one of the small index cards stuffed into his jacket pockets. If he can't find Foster soon, he'll take out a warrant for his arrest, a kind of time out to make sure a parolee doesn't disappear. Figueroa has 40 or so parolees to keep up with. As we walk down the street, he describes this game of cat and mouse.
I feel like I'm chasing ghosts because I'm just basically going from one hotel to the other, or one street corner to the other, or a homeless shelter, one homeless shelter to another, looking for them. And sometimes it's a big chess game. I have to try to find out where they're going to be next and use community resources to try to hunt them down.
Most of Figueroa's parolees are second strikers, serious, violent, repeat criminals. We visit one of them. His first name is Charles. Charles had his first run-in with the law in 1984.
Me and a lady had got into it, and she called me out my name. And I went at her neck and her chain. When I went at her neck and she snatched back, her chain broke and it was on my hand. They call that some kind of robbery. I don't know what it is, but they call that a robbery.
His most recent crime, second-degree robbery and assault with great bodily injury. Charles has been out of prison almost a year. He tells Figueroa that's the longest he's ever been out.
What makes the difference? You're doing so well now.
Oh, wow. Well, I guess I might as well say all the love and support that I'm getting from a lot of people and you constantly keeping me on the right track, making sure I don't do nothing wrong.
Charles is a very intense man, and his tone soon changes. Sitting on the couch of his sister's house, you can sense the anger he feels, and he describes the financial pressure he's under, and he complains bitterly that he can't get a job without a California ID.
Now, it's a lot of people that I done met this year right here that said, man, as soon as you get your California ID, give us a call. But it's so easy for me to go back to the penitentiary, but it's hard as hell for me to get my California ID because I don't even know where I was born at. But now if I go outside and the police stop me and pull me over and I don't have no ID on me, I can easily catch a violation for coming in contact with a police officer. And I don't have no ID.
It's frustrating.
Yeah, it's frustrating. That's back to the penitentiary.
Back in the car, I ask Figueroa about his work. He says the way it used to be, most parole officers came from inside the Department of Corrections. They were former prison guards.
When you have somebody that comes from the institution, when you come out, you have a certain way of looking at and interacting with parolees, sometimes maybe interacting with them as you would in an institution.
Meaning they carry a bit of that guard-prisoner mentality to the streets. Not Figueroa. He came in nearly 10 years ago as an outsider. He has a master's degree in counseling and psychology. Figueroa says he tries to treat his clients the way he treats anyone else, perhaps because they remind him of the kids he knew growing up in East Oakland.
I knew that a lot of my friends were good people. They just made poor decisions. I look at my clients and parolees the same way. At that point in their life, they made a bad decision. It doesn't mean that they're going to make bad decisions in the future.
That belief is put to the test every day. Many of Figueroa's clients have serious mental health problems, including Ezekiel Hoyt. We meet up with him at a drug treatment program.
I kind of fell off the wagon a little bit and relapsed on marijuana and alcohol and stopped taking my medication.
Hoyt describes his struggle with schizophrenia.
So I have a few personalities, and they come into contact with, in collision with each other, and they fluctuate from time to time, and so I have to keep that in check.
With a shaved head, stylish glasses, and sharp clothes, you could easily mistake Hoyt for an artist or an architect. But he went to prison for using a pipe to threaten two people he was living with, including an elderly woman. Hoyt meets privately with Figueroa in another room, and then the three of us head outside to the car.
I'm going to get Ezekiel his meds because he's been having a hard time getting up there, and I just want to make sure he gets some.
As we drive to a pharmacy nearby, Figueroa describes the game plan.
I have to try to put him back on track again and get him to refocus on what he needs to do in order to stabilize him.
Figueroa walks Hoyt up to the pharmacy window.
Yeah, they typically would.
No, they don't always cover.
He even helps with the copay.
I'll help you out for a short term, okay?
Yeah.
Well, 20 minutes later, psych meds in hand, we leave the store.
Solved that problem.
Thank you. It was a problem.
So no excuses, all right?
Figueroa sees his job as keeping the community safe by helping his parolees get stable and stay out of trouble.
The main thing is you're taking your medication, right?
Yes.
Which is what we need you to do.
As he drives this very troubled parolee back to the drug treatment program, Figueroa has one last piece of wisdom for Hoyt.
Life's a struggle, dude.
Of course.
It's a struggle for me.
Yeah.
It's a struggle for Scott.
Yeah.
It's life is tough.
With Hoyt out of the car, I ask Figueroa where the line is between his social work and law enforcement. I mean, how many times, how many warnings, how many problems? I mean, what's the tipping point for you, finally?
Every case is different. The tipping point is if there's threats of violence involved, somebody may get hurt. That, for me, is a huge red flag.
3 days later, Ezekiel Hoyt crosses that line. He threatens staff at the drug treatment program, gets arrested, and is sent to San Quentin Prison. He's now there awaiting a hearing to see how long he stays in prison before getting released, again on parole, and back under the watch of Agent Martin Figueroa. And you can see photos of Martin Figueroa and Ezekiel Hoyt at our website, californiareport.org. Sharing photos is easier than ever now, and we'd like to see yours. We're creating a new photo gallery. It's called Only in California, and that's where you come in. We want to share your images of the people, places, and experiences that make California unique. You'll find details on our website. Once again, it's californiareport.org. A new play called Ask a Mexican has its world debut this weekend. It's based on a nationally syndicated advice column with the same name. The Mexican in question is Orange County writer Gustavo Arellano. The California Report's Los Angeles bureau chief Chrissy Clark has this profile.
All the questions start the same. Dear Mexican. Gustavo Arellano scrolls through a giant list of the ones he hasn't had time to answer yet, 280 pages worth.
Times New Roman, 12 points, single space. You see all the pages just... It's like a stock ticker.
Stupid questions, scholarly ones, political, racist, just plain bizarre.
The three most asked questions I get. Why do Mexicans swim with their clothes on? Why do Mexicans like Morrissey and the Smiths so much? And then the third one, what part of the legal don't Mexicans understand?
There's no question he won't answer. With satire, maybe a little Spanglish, his answers usually offend some group or several at a time. Take the answer to, what part of illegal don't Mexicans understand?
Well, the illegal part. Illegal is a word in English and Mexicans only speak Spanish.
He then points out that a lot of U.S. employers don't seem to understand the word either. Arellano became the Dear Abby of all things Mexican reluctantly. In 2004, he was a new reporter for the Orange County Weekly, and his editor dared him to do a column answering questions about Mexicans.
I don't know. I just didn't think it was going to be that interesting. Like, who even has questions about Mexicans? Obviously, I was very, very wrong.
That he could be so wrong is a big part of why the column works. Arellano realized there was something to the fact that his own coworker, who was white, saw anything worth explaining about the basic details of Arellano's day-to-day life in suburban California.
I understand why. Whenever you have a new group of people, there are going to be questions, but it's scary in a sense that America still views Mexicans in such a alien fashion, these strangers that need explanation.
But if they needed explaining, Arellano was in a good position to do it.
My dad came to this country in the trunk of a Chevy in 1968, paid $50 from Tijuana up to Chinatown in Los Angeles. That was the first time he came illegally. Another time he hopped a fence. Another time he crawled through a sewer. Every which way but loose, my dad came to this country.
And most of his friends' dads. The school he went to in Anaheim in the early 1980s was 80% Mexican.
Of course, when I grew up and I realized a lot of people thought that my family's way of life was horrific and leading to the downfall of America, that upset me, but you grew up with it. It's like, whatever.
Arellano's column toys with Mexican stereotypes. The logo is a fat guy with a gold tooth and sombrero. His column winks at caricatures of Mexican culture, then explains the nuances. He uses history, etymology, and personal anecdote to turn immigration debates on their head. And in the process, he's built a devoted following made of Anglos, Mexicans, Americans. What started as a column became a book, and this weekend, Arellano is in New York to watch the first public reading of Ask a Mexican, the play. He co-wrote it. At Calacas Mexican Curio Shop in Orange County, Arellano's off-Broadway debut already has support from faithful readers.
Good for Gustavo!
Like Estela Gonzalez.
Oh man, this guy is really smart. He takes, you know, stereotypes and twists them around. He can give as good as he gets.
But outside the shop, Valerie Fernandez says the whole idea behind Ask a Mexican has gotten kind of old.
It's like, okay, we get it. Kind of flogging a dead horse sort of situation, but
she's not the only one who's sick of the questions. Arellano says he can't wait until Ask a Mexican seems as outdated as Ask an Irishman or Ask a Jew.
As antiquated as the ethnic comedic duos of the early 1900s. Yes, the day this column is no longer needed will be a glorious day because that means that Mexicans are finally accepted into the United States.
As long as the questions keep coming, he says he'll answer them, in print or off-Broadway. For the California Report, I'm Chrissy Clark in Los Angeles.
Somewhere just south of the Canadian border, a young man from Berkeley is starting an extraordinary odyssey. Sam Fox is running the entire length of the Pacific Crest Trail from Canada to Mexico with the goal of breaking the current speed record of 65 days. But this long-distance challenge is about much more than breaking a record. Dave Iverson caught up with Sam Fox just before he set out on his journey.
My name is Sam Fox. I'm 24 years old, and I'm training, have been for the last 10-11 months, to break the speed record on the Pacific Crest Trail. The Pacific Crest Trail is 2,650 miles long and runs from border to border, Canada to Mexico. The current record is 65 days or thereabouts. My goal is to complete the entire trail in 60 days or less.
In the hills high above Berkeley, Sam Fox is running and running. A former track star at Yale, he's used to the rigors of training. But breaking this record means running 44 miles a day for 60 straight days, a feat that requires training of a different sort.
For me, my training has been less about long distances as it has about long hours and uncomfortable hours. Doing extended periods of time sleeping on rocks, extended hours not drinking enough water, but still having to get from point A to point B.
So have you practiced then, sleeping on rocks, practice not having enough water?
Yeah, I mean, I like doing that stuff. Sometimes it happens when you're not planning for it. You know, sometimes, I don't know, you know, your water bottle cracks and you're out of clean water. And then you fill up a water bottle and you see worms in it and you decide not to drink it. So you go another 18 hours and another 20 miles without any water.
I have to say that I thought it was absolutely nuts when I first heard about it.
That's Lucy Fox, Sam's mother. To do what Sam is doing, you need motivation. Breaking a record provides one sort of motivation. Your mom provides another. 10 years ago, Lucy Fox began experiencing symptoms that couldn't be easily explained. One doctor thought it was multiple sclerosis. Another, Lyme disease. Finally, she got a definitive diagnosis.
So I went to the Mayo Clinic and was diagnosed there with Parkinson's. And in a way, it was a relief because I now had a name but it was quite a devastating diagnosis as well.
Parkinson's is a neurodegenerative condition. Common symptoms include tremor, muscle rigidity, and problems with walking and balance. Medication can help for a while, but the disease is progressive and there is no cure. Lucy Fox wasn't ready to give in.
After about a month of feeling terribly sorry for myself, I realized that I was still alive and I was probably going to do fine. And, you know, why be a complainer? You know, life deals you a hand and you just have to go with it.
It's an approach to life that Sam says he thinks about out on the trail.
She's tough. Very tough. My mom is not Parkinson's disease, so in truth, this isn't about her illness. It's more about what she's taught me.
It's a run, then, that's about way more than breaking a record. It's about honoring an attitude, and it's about raising money for Parkinson's disease research. Sam is collecting pledges for his run with a goal of raising $250,000.
I didn't start this and expect to get emails and phone calls saying, wow, thank you so much, this is inspiring. And I honestly didn't expect that, but it made me realize that we actually can make an influence just by what we do. By what we do, I mean something simple, like running and walking really far.
He's choosing to put all of his energies into a charitable cause, and I am tremendously proud of him. You know, it means a lot to me.
3,000 miles from Berkeley, on their small Rhode Island farm, Sam's parents, Lucy and Jim, are getting ready to travel west and cheer him on as he crosses canyons and mountaintops from Canada to Mexico. And they'll be there to greet him 2,650 miles from now when he finishes.
I don't think that there's any guarantee that Sam will succeed. I think there's a guarantee that he'll give it everything he has. And what I'll say to him probably is something like, well, how are your feet?
Spoken like a mom.
I guess that's really what I am.
Which, in the end, is all the motivation Sam needs.
A lot of families, I think, have a hard time expressing gratitude, their feelings, emotions, all that touchy-feely stuff. My family is one of those families. I'm sure my mom would probably appreciate a letter and a hug more than, you know, me putting myself at risk out on a dangerous and remote trail. But this is what she's getting. She's getting a big I love you over 60 days.
And you can follow Sam's progress online as his 60-day journey continues. All the money he raises will benefit the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Disease Research. For the California Report, I'm Dave Iverson.
That's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Danny Bringer. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen with help from David Marks. Our interns are Julia Bernstein, Bridget Bodner, and Nicholas Carpenter. Our producer is Victoria Malione. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, everybody. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The world standard for solar. SunPowerSolar.com.